I'm honored today to share the podium with this distinguished group of presenters. I really, really enjoyed the morning presentations, and I learned a great deal from them, so I appreciate that. I've spent my career entirely at the U of O focused on school-related behavior disorders involving children who are exposed to a host of at-risk conditions from the moment of birth and have very few protective factors in their lives to buffer and offset the impact of that array of risk to which they are exposed. So the focus of my colleagues and myself has been on the age range about age three to 11 or 12. That's where we've done most of our research. And we've had a very strong focus over the years on achieving prevention outcomes through early intervention, finding these at-risk children as soon as we can and to intervene effectively with the three social agents that have the greatest influence in their lives. And those are parents, teachers, and peers or classmates. Any intervention designed to or expected to alter the trajectories that these children are on has to involve at some level those three types of social agents. And if you can do it in a coordinated, collaborative way, your chances greatly ramp up of achieving successful outcomes. But too often, we sort of operate in silos, separated from each other, and our intervention efforts are poorly coordinated. It's very difficult currently, and has been, to get a federal grant funded that involves the management and implementation of coordinated family and school interventions. There are a whole array of funding opportunities for parent and family-based interventions and supports. And there's an equally large array of funding opportunities for school-based interventions, but try to find federal and certainly not state intervention approaches that involve true collaborations between families and schools. It's like finding hen's teeth. They are very, very rare. So we don't have good research, good activity in that area. And until we do, I'm not optimistic that we're going to realize the sorts of outcomes that we've grown to expect from what we know. So today, I'd like to spend some time talking to you about predicting and preventing future involvement in the criminal justice system. And a major vehicle that I'm going to emphasize is the role that preschools and schools can play. And before starting, I'd just like to say that the landscape and the climate in Oregon in this regard has been positively influenced by two agencies and one development. The development is the leadership that Governor Kitzhaber is demonstrating so well and so clearly in creating a 0 to 20 coordinated, integrated continuum of activities, supports, interventions, and research to make sure that the work that we do is cost-effective and that it addresses this whole issue of silos and different advocacy groups protecting their turf and their funding. I fully believe that Governor Kitzhaber will be able to take that on successfully, and it is really needed. So I hope you'll support his efforts in that regard. And locally, you have two resources in Portland that I am really supportive of. One is the Children's Institute, and the other is the Oregon Citizens Crime Commission. And both organizations have been very effective advocates for this agenda, for finding these at-risk children and youth early, developing wellness programs, and trying to get them on a path or a track that achieves, that results in school success and avoids a host of problems later on that are often associated with school failure and dropouts. So I want to just note that I'm a loyal duck, and I always have the duck icon on the first slide. I also want to note that I don't think a duck is terribly intimidating as a animal mascot. I mean, in the Pac-12, we have that's New Mexico, the Lobos. We have huskies, we have cougars, we have bears, and we have bruins. And all of those are, you know, really, really impressive mascots. So I worry about the duck. I, like a typical professor, I have included a whole series of handouts on the disc that each of you have. And these handouts consist of fact sheets on different topics that I think are very important related to this agenda. Lists of resources that you can pursue on your own. And three articles that I think are worth reading. And this first article here is now 20 years old, and it basically poses a question: what is the role of schools in preventing or offsetting the path that so many of our children and youth follow to prison? And typically, schools are more like a way station, or, to use old West parlance, a stagecoach stop along the way to prison, to that path. And I want to make the case to you today that schools, particularly early on, can play a very, very powerful role in breaking that up, in diverting children, getting them off that path, and so on. So, these are some areas of expertise that my colleagues and I are invested in the IVDB. We are strongest in this area, this area, this area, here, and here. If you would like to learn how to become violent or destructive, we have the means to teach you. Here is a path that the economic and social conditions of our society are placing thousands and thousands and thousands of children on every single year. And it starts out from the moment a child is born with exposure to a host of risks in such domains as family, neighborhood, school, and community or society. Consistent and pervasive exposure to this set of risks ultimately leads to what we call maladaptive behavioral manifestations. In other words, if you're exposed to these things long enough and you don't have protective factors and influences in your life to buffer and offset them and reduce them, ultimately, it's going to show up in your behavior. And where it often shows up is well before a child has his or her first schooling experience. So these little guys come into preschool or kindergarten or first grade acting like Attila the Hun, Eric the Red, and Ivan the Terrible. And schools simply are not set up to deal effectively with children who present that kind of behavioral profile. What they tend to do is control, contain, and punish, you know, as you were noting this morning, rather than to identify them early and try to determine the causes of their maladaptive behavior. What is it about the setting that makes it so difficult for them to engage in behavior that allows them to consume instruction, make friends, respond to the teacher and other adults appropriately, and so on? So the most critical point in a child's educational career is around kindergarten and grade one. The sort of start that you get off to at that period of time has a huge influence on how you're perceived in that school, what happens to you, outside of school. So we find, our research and others finds, that children who bring this Attila the Hun sort of behavior pattern and persona to school, within by the end of the first grade, have been rejected by most of the peers that they come in contact with. By the end of the second grade, they've established a really strong reputation as a troublemaker, as a problem source, and so on. Teachers are lining up to say, I don't want that one in my room next year. There's a sorting kind of process, so they try to put these difficult students with the best teachers, which, you know, replicates Ricardo's law of diminishing returns. You can only handle so many of these along with a full classroom of students. So if they persist in this behavior pattern, they are fully rejected by almost all of the peers that they come in contact with, except a small group. And that's all the other students in the school like them. So around the fourth or fifth grade, they discover each other. And they bond together in what's called a deviant peer group. And so say I'm one of these guys, you know, Ivan the Terrible, Eric the Red. I might be approached by a delegation of peers consisting of membership in this deviant peer group, and the conversation would go somewhat like this. A number of us have been observing your behavior for some time, and frankly, we like what we see. And we'd like to know if you're here to join our little deviant peer group. So I might say, why should I give a fig about your deviant peer group? And the answer is that, oh, you don't know what you're missing. We drive teachers nuts. We torture peers. We ritually sacrifice small animals at recess. After school, we break and enter. We do drugs, you know, so on and so forth. So it's like joining a fraternity or sorority or any other group. There are certain admission criteria. So if I pass those, if I meet those criteria and pass whatever admission rituals there are, I become a bona fide member of this group. Guess what? I have my first felony arrest within 2 years in about half the cases. That's quite an accomplishment. So, if I continue along this path, I'm going to experience a host of negative short-term outcomes, like truancy, and as I said, now peer and teacher rejection is a well-established fact. Often by age 10 or 11, these children are rejected by their own parents. Low academic achievement almost goes without saying. a high number of school disciplinary referrals that produce a written record. So schools record disciplinary referrals, thank you, that are major enough to result in being written up. So they're serious. And a large number of different schools attended. I know this for a fact, that many school administrators have this little covenant agreement. I will take your worst case student at some point in the future if you take Fred today. So it's like an NFL, draft exchange. I'll give you two Freds and Hazel for one Jimmy. What happens is many of these children stay in the same neighborhood, but they will have 3, 4, and 5 different elementary schools that they've attended by the time they get to middle school. Well, that turns out to be a really good predictor of school dropout and a host of other problems. So if, again, I continue on this, I experience school failure and dropout, delinquency, drug and alcohol use. Sometimes I'm recruited by a gang, often violent acts, adult criminality, lifelong dependence sometimes on the welfare system, and higher death and injury rates. Now, obviously, not every child who follows this path experiences all of these outcomes. But what research over the last 25 years has shown is that this process right here replicates in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the U.S., and most of the countries in Western Europe. Psychological and sociological researchers have conducted longitudinal studies in all of these countries of that process, and it is, in fact, an unfortunate occurrence that replicates over and over and over. So I have been fascinated by how these little guys behave, and especially how they view themselves and the world and their place in it. And it tells me that when you try to change a child's behavior to make them more successful, to teach them how to make friends, to get along with adults in their lives better, so on and so forth, you need to address their cognition. You need to get at how they see themselves in the world, how they think. Because so many of them have normative beliefs that are out in left field. And they don't necessarily think they're all that far off the bubble. And they really are. They are inured from reality testing. They don't do a lot of reality testing of their behavior and attitudes. So, for example, we're developing this program for addressing very aggressive behavior of students in the primary grades, like kindergarten, first, second, and third. And we had a referral process where we would record direct observations of children's behavior who were referred to us from the local schools. And we would ask the observers, as they coded the child's behavior into specific categories, to write down things that the child did that were inappropriate, aggressive, off the scale, and so on. So this observer came back the first day, and she had an 8.5 by 11 page, single-spaced of things this guy had done. Hits, bites, kicks, scratches, yells. And so I'm thinking, wow. So the next day, I went out with the observer to watch him on the playground. And he was holding forth, behaving like Attila the Hun with his classmates. And he was a second grader. Well, while I'm standing there, he goes over to a first grader, totally unprovoked, goes up to the little boy and starts choking him. And he has him down on the ground, seriously choking this little boy. So the recess supervisor rushes over to break it up. So that's what you call a blue light special in schools. You know, it's a parent conference, the counselor's involved, the vice principal, principal, and so on. So this entourage is out there, and they're escorting this little boy in to call his parents. So I wanted to know what he was thinking about, what was inside his head. So I said, do you mind if I ask you a question?
Sure.
Can you tell me why you were choking that old boy? And he looked at me like I was out to lunch, and he said, well, it was recess. How could I not know that? So that's an example of that kind of normative belief that's off the chart that he thinks, you know, what's the matter with that? It's recess. Another one, a little more sophisticated, involved a third grade girl in Longmont, Colorado, and I won't use her actual name, but say it's Sarah. She attended a small school, and the school psychologist who handled Sarah's school also handled two other schools. And the reason I know her was that she's the wife of the co-founder of the Sopras West Publishing Company, which has published a lot of our work. Her name is Billy Webb, you know, the school site. So Billy would visit all three schools once or twice a week, depending on, you know, the caseload and the problems and so on. Well, Sarah and Billy were on a first-name basis because every time Billy came to her school, she had to see Sarah about something Sarah did or was doing on the playground. So one day, Billy shows up, and the principal and the counselor are waiting at the door and said, you have to call Sarah in, talk to her, and do something. So Billy calls in Sarah, and they're in a room together. And Billy said, well, Sarah, I understand you've been having problems yet again on the playground. Sarah didn't say anything. She just looked at her. And trying to engage Sarah in a problem-solving sort of dialogue, she said, well, Sarah, what do you think people are going to say about that? You know, what she did on the playground, and she recounted to Sarah what she'd done. Sarah thought a minute and looked at Billy and said, well, Billy, some people might say you're not doing your job. So, I would like to know how Sarah turns out 15 years from now. But this business of not assuming responsibility for your behavior and for changing it is a characteristic of these students. Having weird normative notions about what's appropriate and not in terms of peer relations, relating to adults, and so on, is something else. So how do these students get this way? What are the pathways that they follow? There are three major pathways. Covert behavior, which tends to start reasonably early, involving stealing, burglary, lying, drugs and alcohol, and so on. And their antisocial behavior is directed toward property, self, or both. This represents the smallest number of students who develop an antisocial behavior pattern. The most frequent pathway is this one involving highly aggressive behavior, use of coercive tactics, and victimizing others. And bullying, coercion, manipulation, aggressive confrontations with teachers, peers, and parents, and generally directed toward others, rarely toward self, obviously. And then there's the oppositional pathway, featuring primarily disobedient behavior. It starts in the home, and parents tend to respond poorly to instances of noncompliance, and it can evolve into defiance if it's allowed to continue. Parents get into all kinds of struggles with their children about noncompliance and following rules and so on in the home. And I'm going to show you a little videotape clip later on about a program called RIP. It's a regional intervention program developed at Vanderbilt University in the early 70s. And it's still widely used, and it features a very effective intervention program where parents are taught how to positively react to their child's behavior and not to reinforce and strengthen non-compliant deviant behavior. Many of the parents who participate in this regional intervention program are literally held hostage by very tantruming, non-compliant, defiant children. So imagine living with that on a daily basis. There are also late and early starters. Early starters in terms of an antisocial behavior pattern are socialized to delinquent antisocial behavior from birth. They suffer high levels of social rejection, and they frequently fail in school academically. Later starters are students who have a lot of protections or protective influences in their lives and very few risks, but they get fascinated with this deviant peer group, and they say, I want to be a part of your group because it looks like a lot of fun. So they tend to be less at risk because of their stronger academic skills, good social skills, and generally good peer relations. These youth are more likely to persist in this behavior pattern into adulthood. Generally, what happens with these is they get into it at the beginning of middle school or late elementary, stay in it 3 or 4 years, and then come to their senses. This is a strategy that antisocial, agitated students generally develop at home, interacting with parents and family members. And it's a very successful one. When demands are placed on them to do something they don't want, they don't particularly feel like doing at the moment, say, they begin to bristle and get agitated. Sometimes parents, it'll cause the parent to back off and say, well, if you don't want to do it now, maybe later. And then sometimes they don't ever have to do what's being asked. So what's the message? By bristling, getting agitated, engaging in defiant behavior, it has real instrumental value. It lets you escape from expectations that are generally reasonable. So if the parent insists, though, on making the case that the child needs to do whatever, respond to the demand, they develop the ability to accelerate and get in the parent's face and become really threatening and objectionable. This generally results in some kind of explosive peak that results in name-calling, you know, throwing things, insults, you know, and so on. And then after that, there's a fairly quick de-escalation and recovery. Well, these little Ivan the Terribles and Eric the Reds become very skilled at using this strategy to control and manage their social environment. You know, they use it with peers and friends and so on. And they come to school, and guess what? They bring it with them. So we do not teach our teachers at universities and teacher training colleges how to deal with this. This is a new animal. So this student walks in to a classroom and probably thinks to himself, gee, I wonder how it'll work here. And fairly quickly, the student has an opportunity to try this out with the teacher. And teachers making normal demands on these students suddenly are confronted by this little tornado that is defiant, calling the teacher whatever, refusing to do what the teacher asks. And the teacher's kind of like... And so generally what happens is that teacher says, you can't defy me like that, and proceeds to try and enforce the command or the request or whatever it is. And these students will have no compunction about continuing to get in the teacher's face, blow up, have a tantrum, explode, and so on. So you have 30 or 35 very interested observers watching all this. And if the teacher succeeds in getting the child to comply, you've created a situation where that child is motivated to get revenge. But if instead the student gets the better of the teacher and the teacher has to back off and so on, imagine what it does to the teacher's ability to manage and teach that classroom. So it's a no-win situation for teachers. So in this situation, you have a professional and an amateur. Would you care to guess which is which? The professional is about this tall. So the name of the game here is the minute you find yourself in the early stages of one of these escalating interactions, you call time out, you say, I'm not answering any more questions, no more prompts, and you take the child to the office or you terminate the interaction, get the child to a place where they can calm down. As long as you're willing to respond to the child's provocations, to answer questions, to deal with anything, who's in control of it? It's not the teacher. It's a student. So every teacher in America needs to learn how to deal with this because it really does drive a lot of hostile teacher-child and peer-to-peer interactions. We worked with the Oregon Social Learning Center, which is a world-class group of psychologists in Eugene who do research on families that produce antisocial students and youth. And so in collaboration with them, we identified from their sample of 200 at-risk boys the 40 most aggressive antisocial students in their sample. And then we randomly selected another 40 from the sample of 200 at-risk boys and studied them as a contrast group. So we began studying these boys in the fourth grade and followed them through high school. What you have here is the arrest rate, and arrests begin about grade five for this group and slowly accelerates throughout their school careers. But these very antisocial boys, I'm not exactly sure when they begin engaging in arrestable behavior, but it's at least by grade four. So this is the number of arrests per grade for these 40 boys. And here are the yearly number of arrests for these at-risk boys. Interestingly, at the end of high school, they end up at about the same place. But experts say that for every arrestable offense, there are 7 to 10 arrests that don't happen. So you've got this ratio. I think this group of boys produce about 400 arrests. And if you multiply that by 10, you would have the upper limit of the swath of destruction that they are cutting through the Eugene community. What are the risk factors for adolescent delinquency? Steve Carmichael was the Lane County Youth Services Director for how long?
About 10 years.
Very thoughtful, forward-looking professional. And he would see about, or his program would see about 800 to 900 adolescents a year. And he had a question. He wanted to know which ones of those he would see only once, and which ones he would see over and over and over and over coming back. So he took all the data that he had, called in the Oregon Social Learning Center analysts, and asked them to distill down a profile that would predict which of those 800 and some students would come back, would be recidivist. And here's what they came up with. And it's very sensitive, very powerful, highly discriminating, and it replicates. Mother or father has ever been arrested even before the child was born. Child has been a client of child protection, you know, for obvious reasons. The child manifested an early severe antisocial behavior pattern. And there have been one or more family transitions involving death, divorce, trauma, and family upheaval. This is the one that intrigues me, has received special education services. What it tells me is that special education and similar services act as both a risk and a protective factor. If you need it and have to have it, it means you've been exposed to risks that have put you at a disadvantage. And it can also be a protective influence and a support service that helps get you off the path and on a good one. But that profile is very, very powerful. So the message that I try to give a lot is that you need to find these students as early as possible in preschool, kindergarten, or as soon as their regular school careers begin. And unfortunately, educators aren't listening to that message very well. The public schools in America identify and certify and provide services to about 1% of the population of today's students. Because of severe emotional and behavioral problems that are manifested in school. What is the actual rate or prevalence? Somewhere between 15 and 20%. All kinds of experts argue that up to 20% of the school-age population, depending on the school and the region and all of this, could benefit substantially from support services, especially provided early. So this is U.S. Office of Special Education data from 93, 97, and 98, showing the frequency of students identified by grade level. What do you note about this graph? We wait and wait and wait to identify these at-risk children. We should be ramping up our efforts right here, and we're not. We wait until they have 8, 9, or 10 years of investment in a behavior pattern that leads to school failure, dropout, all kinds of chaos before doing anything. So what is screening and identification rate like for childhood autism? Totally different. They are identified very, very, very early in their life and development. And by the time you get up into high school, a large proportion have been identified and are being served. So when I go out and talk about universal proactive screening, I feel like the driver of this truck. These little boys are expecting ice cream and yogurt, and I'm selling liver and onions. And liver and onions don't even appear on the menu of most restaurants anymore. Growing up, they did. But I'm telling them, I'm trying to sell them on something they really don't want to buy. And I was presenting on this topic in Wyoming one time, and urging proactive universal early screening. And this elementary principal came up to me after I got through, and he said, let me get this straight. Are you trying to make me better at something I already don't want to do? And I said, well, I guess you could look at it like that. And he said, is this anything like a Roundup? And I thought the case was. So there have been a huge number of important innovations developed over the past 15 to 20 years in better serving at-risk students. This is a list of some of them. If we could implement well half of what we know, we could radically transform schools and the lives of these students. The problem is getting educators and parents to work together to implement well these proven practices and programs that we know work. My voice is getting a little... on the PowerPoint that's in your packet, there are some examples of universal, selected, and targeted interventions that I think are really effective. And I go around the country promoting these, and I feel an awful lot like this cowboy whose task it is to herd cats. And you can see the dramatic impact that the cowboy's herding behavior is having. But, excuse me, there was a program implemented in the Seattle Public Schools by David Hawkins Catalano and their associates in the 80s and early 90s. And what they were interested in doing was seeing whether they could improve school engagement and attachment and to serve as a protective factor in preventing destructive outcomes in adolescents by intervening early, like in grades 1 to 3, in grades 4 to 5. And so the intervention involved teacher training in behavior management and instructional techniques, parent education on how to parent children more effectively, and social skills and social confidence training for at-risk students. And then they looked at what the results were 10 to 12 years later. And they had a late intervention group and an early intervention group and a control group that got whatever the schools made available. There were no differences whatever between the late intervention group that got it in grades 4 through 6. But the early intervention group who were exposed to this identical intervention in grades 1 to 3 had this kind of superior profile compared to controls. Fewer violent acts or delinquent acts, less heavy drinking, less teenage sex, fewer pregnancies, fewer multiple sex partners, more commitment and attachment to school, better academic achievement, and less school misbehavior. So they intervened for the first 2 years of schooling, and that's what was produced, the results, at age 18. I'll skip this. Okay, some of you have heard of the Olds Nurse Home Visitation Program. Have you? Raise your hand if you have. Yeah, great. David Olds was a 28 or 9-year-old psychologist at the University of Colorado in Denver when he developed this program, and it's sheer genius. And basically, what it is a nurse home visitation program where pregnant, low-income women who meet a certain risk profile are invited to participate in a 2-year intervention from spanning late pregnancy through the first 2 years of the child's life. Public health nurses run this program, and they provide the following services during this 2-year period. And David Olds now has 20 and 25-year follow-up data. And his results show that this program implemented in the first 2 years of life is instrumental in preventing adolescent delinquency, and it also accounts for reductions of substance abuse during pregnancy, reduction in child abuse and maltreatment, reduction in family size in terms of the spacing of children, and reductions in welfare dependence. So if you want to learn about this program, all you have to do is Google David Olds, and he has a wonderful website. But the key to make this work is the use of public health registered nurses, not paraprofessionals, not nurse practitioners, but registered, professionally trained nurses. And finally, the regional intervention program that I mentioned earlier is a trainer of trainers program where parents who are held captive by tantruming, aggressive, defiant children come into a setting where they learn how to manage their children more effectively, and they learn from other parents who've been through this, who are taught how to successfully interact with and support their child's behavior. I was going to show you a clip from it, but we're out of time. It's on your disk in your packet, so I urge you to look at it. It's about a 15-minute videotape. Just to give you one more slide. Oops. They have conducted 25-year follow-up studies of two cohorts of RIP graduates. And this is from the second cohort. And they looked at 40 of these RIP graduates in one cohort and 40 in another. All but one of them completed high school, and a majority went on to college and graduate school. All but one was currently employed. During adolescence, one experimented with illegal drugs, and one, the high school dropout, was involved in the justice system for theft. None of them was identified for special ed or was emotionally disturbed.
There were no reports of their being aggressive toward parents, peers, or teachers. And after 25 years, most parents had very positive things to say about this program and their experience in it. This is my idea of effective program for a very difficult population. When you look at the videotape and the kind of behavior these little guys are displaying toward their parents, you won't believe these results. So I just want to reinforce that we know, we have the means, the knowledge, the techniques. We know how to have a huge impact on this population in terms of prevention, but you have to start early. Ideally, you start before they hit the regular school system, and you stay with it. And the three pressure points are the most important points to intervene at are the start of school, the transition to middle school, and the transition out of high school to adult living. That's where we need to concentrate major resources and efforts. And I'm optimistic that the governor's leadership around this agenda will move us in that direction. Thank you so much for listening.